This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A group of 15 Tibetans, mostly monks and nuns, recently escaped Tibet by making a treacherous journey that took 14 days, covered 400 miles, and took them through the Himalayas. They endured frostbite, fatigue, and snow blindness while eluding Chinese soldiers. My guest Jeffrey Fleischman made most of the journey with the Tibetans, reporting on it for the Philadelphia Inquirer as part of their recent series on Tibet. China invaded Tibet in 1950 and ever since has tried to eradicate Tibetan religion and culture. Thousands of monks and nuns have been killed and virtually all the monasteries have been destroyed. An estimated 700 Tibetans are now in prison for political offenses. Several of the monks and nuns who recently escaped are former political prisoners. I asked Jeffrey Fleischman to describe their escape route.
The escape route was 400 miles, and it started in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, and it went through Shigatse and then on to Shagar, and most that leg of it was done on the truck. And then the last 90 miles were done on foot, and they went from Shagar down into the heart of the Himalayas, where you could see Mount Everest off to the side, and then it continued further into the Himalayas until they hit the Nangpala Pass, which at the top of that is the border between Nepal and Tibet. And then once they crossed that, they headed for a little town called Chelsea, and then eventually on to Kathmandu, where they were put in a refugee center.
Who is the guide?
The guide has been doing this for probably 4 or 5 years. His name is Dorji, which is equivalent to John in Tibetan, and that's all we used was his first name. And he was very conservative, but he had the look of a warrior. And he immediately, with the Tibetans, his presence was immediately calming to them because obviously they were escaping for their lives and there was a lot of fear and tension through most of the trek. And when he was around, he was just a very calming influence. He was about 5'6", 129 pounds, but he could carry 100 pounds on his back going up a steep mountain passes while he was smoking a cigarette. He was just an amazing character. And when during the trek, especially at night when the Tibetans would grow tired, I noticed that they would walk up to the front of the pack where he was and reach out and hold his hand, almost like they were getting strength off his aura. And then after a few minutes, they would let go and another one would replace them. And he was an energy field for them. And they stuck very close to him and listened to everything he said.
What was his motivation? He had made this trek a lot of times and saved, according to your article, about 500 people?
500 people. His motive, I asked him that because I wanted to know what made this man do this and risk his life, not only being captured, but going over these mountain passes all the time back and forth where the conditions were extreme. And he gave me a two-pronged answer. And the first part was, first of all, Tibetans are so honest that when you ask them a question, they just open right up to you. It's amazing. It's so different from being a journalist in the West and interviewing people where there's always sort of somebody hiding something and you're always wondering. The Tibetans just tell you like it is. And I asked him, and he said, well, first of all, that it was a job. And they paid about equivalent of about 250 American dollars, each one of them, to get over. And there were no other jobs for Tibetans really in Tibet as China was squeezing the country. And so this was a way of income for him. But secondly, and most importantly, after spending time with him, his second answer, I think, was the more accurate. And he said, he was a very humble man, and he said, look at me, I don't speak even my language very well. I'm uneducated, and I can't really help the Tibetan cause. But if I get these, and he pointed over to the monks and nuns, if I can get our educated out who know English, who know Tibetan, who can do something for our cause, then that is what my duty and that is what I must do to help my people. And after spending time with him, I think that was his real motivation.
How would he deal with it if somebody was lagging behind or, you know, they were having trouble with their footing on the mountain passes? Would he be sympathetic or just urge them to just keep moving?
He was sympathetic to a point. And the first night we found out only how far sympathy went. And it was There were three monks on the trek who were fairly well-known political dissidents, and he had to get them out. And he cut the size of the trek down to 15 people to get these people out. And this was a fast-moving trek, and he made that known up front, that we have to move, we can't stop, we have to hike 10 and 12 hours a night and rest little and get up and go again. The first night, we had with us a nun who had tried twice to escape, and she had hepatitis, and the time previous to this one, the hepatitis made her turn back. She was very ill. She was really dying, and I don't know why he brought her along this time. I think she begged him. She had a strong will, and she wanted to get out, and she came with her best friend, who was also a nun, and as we left the first night's trek, only about a half an hour into the trek, maybe not even that long, she lagged further and further back, and he knew that
the nun with hepatitis
mm-hmm. lagged further back, and he knew she's never going to make it. We've got 7 days in Tibet ahead of us, over, and then we have to go over the Nangpala Pass at 18,500 feet. She's not going to do it. So he stopped the trek. He turned back to her. She and her friend kind of came up very slowly, both crying, and he said to her, "You're not going to make it." The friend who had hepatitis. And she just dropped to the ground and said, "Please take me. I can't go back." And then he looked to her friend, and he said to her, "You have to stay with her." And she bowed her head. She was very humble, and she said she had just gotten out of prison. And she said, "Please don't make me stay. I have to go. It's terrible, but I have to go." And her friend who had hepatitis, who was on the ground, grabbed this woman's leg. And it was her desperate attempt to stay with her. And the friend who was standing broke that grip and got to the healthy side of the pack. And I remember standing there in the dark, and the starlight was so bright. And I just remember thinking, it was like a pack of animals when it sensed a sick one, and all the healthy ones gathered on one side. And Dorji, who was the guide, bent down to this kind of just silhouette in a shadow, and said, you just heard this crinkle of money, and he handed it to her, and he said, "Try to get to the road if you can in the morning." And then he got closer to her, and he whispered in her ear, and he said, "I promise you within the month I will get you to freedom." And then just as quiet and a moment as that was, he stood up, turned around, and just started marching as fast. And everyone just fell in formation with him. And everyone just looked back from time to time until this woman was just melted into the darkness. And that was the first night. So you knew that he was sympathetic, but the mission was clear, and that was escape and freedom. And there were casualties along the way, like this woman.
Do you know what happened to her?
No, we were still trying to find out what happened to her, but we don't know if she made it out or if she died right there on the plateau.
Before you crossed the border, you were all concerned about being discovered by Chinese guards.
Right.
Chinese military?
Chinese military. We constantly saw during the truck ride convoys of Chinese military passing us all the time, and there were checkpoints all over the place.
Did you all have a cover story in case you were discovered by the Chinese military?
Our cover story was, for the photographer, myself, and the interpreter, was that we had a trekking permit. And so we were allowed to be in that region trekking, because Everest and a lot of places where Westerners go to trek was right where we were. So our story was going to be, if we were caught by the Chinese with the Tibetans, that we were just trekking in this area and came across some Tibetans and just thought it'd be fun to hike and tag along with them. Where we could have gotten in trouble if they didn't buy that story and started going through our bags, through our notebooks, all the film that the photographer had, and then if they were to find out that our interpreter, who was an American, spoke Tibetan, our cover would have been blown a little there. But luckily that didn't happen.
What was the worst you came across in the weather and in the climb?
The climb itself, the worst we came across was the last night that we were with them. It was a trek that left The whole day we had spent cramped in a sheep pen with sheep manure just all over the ground, and we had to hide there all day. And the sun was beating down, and that took enough out of everybody. And the Tibetans were playing cards, and some were chanting and praying. And you had this whole sort of camaraderie in this tiny sheep pen about the size of a living room. And then when the sun went down, the temperatures dropped drastically that night. And at about 7 o'clock or 7:30, we took off walking. And Dorji, the guide, said we had to cross 3 rivers that night and then get across a valley and into the mountains before the Chinese. So when the sun came up, we weren't visible to the Chinese. And that was the worst night because the rocks in this terrain would be like large, almost ostrich eggs, and they would stick up all over. So you would walk and you couldn't see that well, and you'd hit a rock and you'd fall over. And most of us had on 25 or 30-pound packs. The altitude being that high would suck the air right out of you. You'd fall over. You'd have to get back up. Sometimes somebody would help one another back up. But Dorji kept it moving and moving, so you were constantly in this state of flux even when you fell. And you knew that if you fell far behind, you could be lost out here. And you constantly heard the deep-throated sounds of these dogs that were trained by Tibetan farmers, and sometimes they were wild dogs, but they were trained to go to the throat to protect their barley and wheat fields, so you're constantly worried about that. So all these little worries accumulated, and then when the altitude set in on top of that, and then the cold, then it got, I remember I would carry my water bottles to give me a rhythm in walking, and they just both froze solid while the water was moving while I was walking. So it was incredibly cold, and as soon as you'd stop, you'd just immediately become shivering all over the place. And
the people escaping were Tibetan Buddhists, and I'm wondering if you were able to observe anything about how their faith affected them during this period of incredible suffering and tension.
Mm-hmm. Every morning I woke up, it was to a sound of a chanting, this quiet sort of almost lullaby going on over my head in my sleeping bag as this one monk who was in prison and tortured for 6 years, and he just chanted every day. And he was kind of a piece of solace in all of that. And they were all like that. There was one, the old monk, we called him. He was only 57 years old, but compared to everybody else on the trek, he was old. And he just had this bamboo sack, a pack on his back with his ancient scriptures. And he was so worried that if the Chinese touched those scriptures, they would be soiled. And it was his life's mission to get these out to freedom, more so than his life was to get these things to freedom. And their whole belief and system of suffering and accepting suffering, and through other people's suffering to suck out that compassion and sort of move toward your own enlightenment, was constantly prevalent on this trek.
My guest is journalist Jeffrey Fleischman. He reported on the escape of a group of Tibetan monks and nuns for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with reporter Jeffrey Fleischman of the Philadelphia Inquirer. As part of the newspaper's recent series on Tibet, Fleischman, along with an Inquirer photographer and an interpreter, accompanied a group of 15 Tibetans who fled persecution by the Chinese government in Tibet and escaped through the Himalayas. The journalists had to drop out of the final leg of the escape after the photographer suffered severe exhaustion, but they met up with the Tibetans in Nepal. Fleischman told me that perhaps the most treacherous part of the Tibetans' journey was crossing over from Tibet into Nepal.
What the Tibetans faced was the Nangpala Pass that they had to go up to reach that border was 18,500 feet. So the oxygen level was just about cut in half, maybe more than what it would be at elevation where we are now in the United States. And what happened there, as they were going up there, they had already had 2 or 3 days with no water, no food, and they tried to melt snow up on the pass to try with a little candle to get water, but that didn't work. And they realized they couldn't stay there; they had to move. This path they followed was part of an old ancient caravan route, and so there were they followed this up, and is a pass that tens of thousands of Tibetans have taken to freedom since 1950 when China invaded, and They had actually come across dead bodies of Tibetans who had died the year before and were frozen in the snow, and nomads had taken these bodies and put them in burlap, and this trek actually came upon them. And then when they finally reached the top of the pass, you would think there would be this euphoric thing. We've reached freedom. We've stepped from China into freedom. But there wasn't. There was all this concern about, okay, we left the Chinese police. We left the possibility and the army of being beaten, of being tortured more, of maybe being killed and thrown in the river. That's what they really believed, that if they were caught by the Chinese, that they would never make it to prison. Then they crossed into Nepal, and that apprehension only went down a few notches because they knew they were carrying bribe money for the Nepali police, because the Chinese would pay the Nepali police for every Tibetan they returned, so they had to do an out-bribing them game. So once they hit that, they felt a little relaxation, and they carried these white paper squares with the Buddhist deities on them. And when they did cross the pass, they threw the squares up into the air and let out a little cheer. And then they draped a white scarf around a pole where there were many already faded and tattered and ripped white scarves of already Tibetans who had already gone through there. And then they moved on again. They knew that until they got to that refugee center, they were never safe. But once they hit that center, their eyes just, they knew it. And when they were finally told, you're okay now, it took them about maybe an hour to really believe that. They wondered, well, maybe this guy will turn us in, or maybe the guy running the center is really Chinese. They're constantly living in fear. And after about an hour, they realize, I'm free.
When was the last time you saw the nuns and monks who you trekked with?
It was at the Chelsea Refugee Center. And they would spend their day eating rice or tiny potatoes about the size of ping pong balls. There wasn't much at the center. It was very poor, very rickety. Everyone slept in this one rickety wooden house with no beds. You just slept on the floor and had fires going. But we spent 3.5 days with them there. And they began to take on weight, and they began to lose their frostbitten scabs and their temperament began to lighten up a little. But then they were concerned, like the monks, their hair had started growing in. So you'd notice changes in them. And then they became more concerned about the families they left behind, because they knew what their families faced once the Chinese discovered that they had escaped. I mean, their families faced torture and other things at the expense of their loved ones escaping. And so their hearts went back to Tibet, but they knew that the journey must take them on.
Do you know what any of them are doing now?
I know the goal of many of them was to be, as I say, be in the presence of the Dalai Lama. That was the thing that kept them going, was the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, we must be in his presence. That to them is the pinnacle, and that's what fueled them and kept their muscles moving. And they wanted to. And being in his presence is really being in Dharamsala, India, and close to him. Some of them wanted to learn English. And so they knew that, like Tashi said, he wanted to master his English because he knew that that politics were the only way to bring change about in his country. And many of them wanted to learn English because they said that is the international language, that is the way to bring change about. We have to communicate, and that's why the Chinese didn't. Although it's a strange conundrum, because the Chinese, for the most part, don't want Tibetans in Tibet. So why won't they let them escape? Why all this rigmarole about stopping these people from going over mountain passes? What we came to find out was that the monks and nuns are the best and the brightest. And I think the Chinese have seen what the Dalai Lama can do on the world stage, commanding attention in Hollywood, Sweden. And these articulate types of people, they don't want out. And they're also scared of, they'll learn the activist and dissident ways and sneak back in and teach others that way. And so so many of them want to work toward improving their country.
There was a shortage of food on the trek. Did you have any more food than the Tibetans did?
Yes, we had brought processed or dried food that we added water to. And so we were okay on the food-wise. We were always concerned about water. But the Tibetans just brought sheepskin pouches of what they call tampa, which is a barley-scented flour, and they roll it into little, almost like cookie dough balls, and they would eat that. And that was their sustenance, as well as yak butter tea. And it's this very bitter tea, and they would drink that. And they were amazed that we were drinking cold water. They kept telling us, don't drink cold water, it's not good for you. They would always drink hot tea. But typical to their nature, the little bit that they had before they ate, they would offer it to us first.
Would you offer them your food?
We would offer food, and we gave some of them socks and some of them gloves. They really were not prepared for the elements. Two of them were in sports jackets to go, and they were in $2 Chinese tennis shoes and pants with no long underwear. And here they are, and going in sub-zero temperatures and 18,000 foot mountain passes, and they weren't dressed for it. And we went dressed for it, and that quickly became our good for us.
My guest is reporter Jeffrey Fleischman of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Jeffrey Fleischman, who accompanied a group of 15 Tibetans as they fled persecution by the Chinese government in Tibet by escaping through the Himalayas. Are you betraying any secrets in this article? Will the Chinese military read your article eventually and say, so that's where the secret path is, and so that's how they get around the checkpoints?
See, the thing that we were concerned about mostly in the article was the protecting Dorji, the guide, because he had to go back into Tibet and do this again. We had a long before the Nangpala Pass is a well-known escape route. It's just that how well the Chinese want to man it. Sometimes they man it really well and cut it off. Sometimes they don't man it that well. It's depending on, but always it's a danger, both environmentally and through armed soldiers for the Tibetans. But the biggest concern in putting the story together was Dorji was such a huge, larger-than-life character in this story that he had to be part of it, but not to the point of identifying him. We weren't going to identify him at all. We were just going to say the guide and not even use his name. And we asked him, we told him to assure him before we left, we're not going to identify you. And we didn't take his picture either. And he said it, and it was almost, maybe it's something that somebody tells you telepathically, but he looked at us and he said, but you can use my name Dorji. And he said that very proud. And it goes back to earlier what I said about this man doing something for his people. And I think he wanted his name attached to that. And Dorji is really like John, so he didn't, in English.
It's a very common name.
Very common name. So we didn't find that to be, and we kept asking him. We had an hour conversation with him about that. But he said, no, you may do that. And so we did.
You were in a very beautiful part of the world, a part of the world that a lot of outdoor enthusiasts save a lot of money to go to. I mean, it's a hobby for a lot of people, you know, adventuring in the Himalayas. Did the beauty strike you while you were trying so hard just to keep moving and to stay alive during all of it?
The beauty was breathtaking. I would open my notebook. I don't know how many times I must have opened my notebook, sat by a stream or sat somewhere, and looked at those mountains and tried to describe them. And it was almost like describing them was almost as difficult a task as climbing one of them. There were no words fit those just chasms of things just rippling across the sky. And somebody had described Appalachian mountains to me once as being looking like a kicked rug. But these were so much larger, so much just so majestic. It was just amazing. So constantly you would see, as we kind of threaded through there, our band of trekkers and monks and nuns with all this sort of cruelty at that level, just your mind would get taken away from it. And sometimes I would look at these mountains and daydream, and that would take away the pain of the walk. So, oh yeah, it was amazing. There were so many ironies captured in that, because you would pass, you'd know that there is at Mount Everest, and there are people who are spending $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 to camp there in north face down, you know, fleece pants, everything for comfort. And here are these little Tibetans in the shadow of this place going across past yaks and wild dogs in sport coats and $2 tennis shoes. And it was such a, it was so East meets West, and the contradictions abounded.
Is this story setting your life in a different direction?
These were the simplest people doing the most extraordinary thing I'd ever witnessed. And they did it never with saying, I, or me. Invariably, after every interview that we had done, a monk would tell us about 6 years in a prison, of being tortured, of being beaten every day, of cattle prodded, of being hung upside down, of being so weak that he was wheeled in a wheelbarrow across the prison grounds because he couldn't stand. And then he would say after that interview, but don't concentrate on me. I only suffered little. And that's the gravity of that would come back to you about things. So I think it changed how I look at suffering and just how we should be as human beings toward one another. And that's taken out of the political context of does China have a legal right to Tibet? Is Tibet really an independent country? This is at a human level, and that's what I took away from it.
Jeffrey Fleischman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, sure. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Jeffrey Fleischman is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His report on the escaping Tibetans was published last month in the Inquirer's Sunday magazine.